Let's go now to Psalm 34, and we'll try to finish it tonight. In fact, we will finish it very quickly tonight. And then we will go to another psalm that was written on about the same occasion when David is in the cave of Adullam. And we'll have two psalms, one of them Psalm 142, and then Psalm 56, which we will get into in our next study. Remember, these are all linked together in the theme of our whole study tonight and the previous study, and probably into next time and for some time to come, is built around the historical event and the spiritual insight. And for that combination of historical event and insight, we have the event recorded in 1 Samuel, and we have the insight, spiritual insight, in the Psalms. And basically everything we've been doing last time and this time will be revolved about this same theme, that certain things happen in the life of David and to David, and then in the book of Psalms we get the insight that he had into those particular events. Many times, or coming out of those events, many times the event will involve some rather sordid things. There'll be a lie involved, dishonesty involved, deception involved, and yet we will find that in a very definite sense from the book of Psalms that there was some divine viewpoint on the part of David. And we're now looking at the time in Psalm 34 that David has pretended that he is insane. And we have him in chapter 21 of 1 Samuel, feigning madness with spit in his beard as he scribbles on the wall, and Psalm 34 is giving us some spiritual insight. Actually, when we come to the part where he feigned madness before the king, we have the remark that he was greatly afraid. And Psalm 34 shows how he got delivered from his fears. Notice down at verse 4, I sought the Lord, he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. And that would take some place up in the cave of Adullam where he was delivered from his fears. So we had, first of all, last time, the call to praise, 34, 1 through 3, and now the call to trust. Psalm 34, 4 through 14. The call to praise, and now the call to trust. And David will give us in these verses two things. First of all, we will have his own personal testimony, or David's personal experience in finding the Lord's delivery, and that is in chapter 34, verses 4 through 7. And then when we come to verse 8, he will say, oh, addressing his audience, taste and see that the Lord is good. So we'll move from David's personal experience in 4 through 7 to the believer's potential experience in verses 8 through 14. So first of all, his personal experience, and first of all, he states it. Personal experience, its statement. Psalm 34, verse 4. And he will be, first of all, very specific. And then he will take the specific statement and he will make it general. So the way the statement will go is a specific statement in verse 4 and then a generalized statement in verse 5. First of all, verse 4. He says, I sought the Lord. He answered me, delivered me from all my fears. The specific statement also, we might put there parenthetically, is the theme of the psalm. Remember, we noted that psalms have different forms. And one of the forms of a praise song or psalm is start out with, let's praise the Lord. And then very briefly, very terse, very short, with no detail, no amplification, he says, now here's what it's going to be all about. And that's what you've got in verse 4. He delivered me from all my fears. And thus, when he says, I sought the Lord, we don't know what he says. He answered me, we don't know the details, but we do know that he was delivered from all of his fears. And that is the theme that is introduced in verse 4. So we're going to find that in this psalm, David will not be delivered physically, but he will be delivered emotionally from his fears. Now notice in verse 5, he takes that statement of his own specific delivery, and he generalizes it. It says, they looked. And the idea involved is his personal experience is going to become a general principle. In other words, God delivered me. Now let me expand that and say this. God can do it for you. In other words, it is a principle that God delivers his own. The specific case was with David in verse 4. Verse 5 now expands it out and makes it much bigger. So the personal experience of David is a principle. That is what God does and is willing and able to do for all of his children. So we go from a case now to a principle. And when he does that, he expresses it in a historical form by saying, they looked. They looked, I believe, would be roughly equivalent, would be whoever looks to him will be radiant. That also can be translated in the Hebrew and is capable of being in the imperative mood. It can be, look to him. If so, that would be addressing those some 400 people that are up in the cave of Adullam with David, and they're all discontented, and they're in debt, and they obviously are looking at their causes of discontent, and he's addressing them and saying, look to him. Now, when you look in verse 5, the word look is very strong. The word look means eager expectancy, is what it points to. Eager expectancy. Now, when I show you the same word in another context, you pick that up immediately. Go back to Numbers 21:9. Numbers 21:9. This is the same word, only it gives enough context that you will get the idea of eager, believing expectation. The incident is the fiery serpents within the camp of Israel. Verse 6, it says, the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many of the people of Israel died. So Moses said, we have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us. And Moses interceded for the people. Then the Lord says, make a fiery serpent, set it on a standard, and it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, shall live. And the word looks is that look. Now, what do you think was involved in that look? Faith, expectation, eagerness. So this is clearly a look of faith that is involved in Psalm 34. So when he says down then at verse 5, they eagerly and expectantly and with faith looked to him, and as a result, they were radiant. Now, when you see in verse 5 that there's a transformation that comes about by a look, keep your finger here and let's get the historical context. 1 Samuel 22. And I'll ask a question and read a verse, and you will be able to answer the question once the verse is read. Going back now to the historical event, David is in the cave of Adullam. This is where the psalm originated. And he is exhorting the people that are with him in the cave. And he says, you need to look to him. Well, what were they looking at? Well, what do you think they were looking at when you read verse 2? Everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. And he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him in this cave of Adullam. So what were they looking at? They were looking at their bills, their empty bank accounts, their lack of money, and apparently a whole other ream of things that made them discontented. They were in a cave, and they weren't radiant. They were complaining. Well, notice his exhortation then in Psalm 34 on that occasion. Verse 5, they looked to him eagerly and expectantly and with faith, and they were radiant. So they were looking at themselves, and they are to turn and look to him, or look to God, and as a result, they will be transformed, and they will be radiant. Keep in mind that setting there, that they were in a cave. Probably it was not wired electrically with light. They were in a dark cave, and he is promising radiance. And you sit there in a dark cave, looking at all of your problems, wonderful promise. You look to the Lord, and in the midst of a dark cave, you'll be radiant. And their faces shall never be ashamed. David then comes back to his testimony and says, this poor man cried, and the Lord heard him, saved him out of all of his troubles, and that is part of his argument. Now, looking at his personal experience stated, and now its support. How can you support the fact that God helped me and he will do it for you? What is the support? Well, David gives those people in the cave two things on which they can rest. Number one, its basis in experience. Second, its basis in doctrine. Its basis in experience, verse 6. Its basis in doctrine, verse 7. In experience, verse 6. This poor man cried and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. And what is David arguing? He's simply saying, God can deliver you, and I'm here to tell you he can do it because he did it for me. Then second, what is the doctrine on which delivery rests? The angel of Yahweh encamps around those who fear him and rescues them. The doctrine, then, is that the angel of Yahweh is always with you. Just a quick rundown on the angel of Yahweh. Number one, Genesis, these are just a few passages now to lead us through, 16, 7 through 13. Genesis 16, 7 through 13. The first statement that we want to make, and we'll do it coming off of this passage, is this. Yahweh and the angel of Yahweh consistently in the Old Testament are viewed as deity, both. Yahweh and the angel of Yahweh are consistently viewed as deity in the Old Testament. And that comes out in many ways, but notice coming down to 16, verse 7. Now the angel of Yahweh found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarah. And the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress, submit yourself to her authority. Moreover, now notice, the angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants. And notice, he's quoting from the Abrahamic covenant. And when he does so, he does not say, Yahweh said that he would multiply you. He picks up with first person as though he had made that covenant. And that's one of the arguments for the identity of the angel with Yahweh, is that he quotes the Abrahamic covenant using first person as though he were Yahweh. I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they shall be too many to count. The angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child. You shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because Yahweh has given heed to your affliction. And so forth, he is described through the context. Then come down to verse 13. She called the name of the Lord, Yahweh, who spoke to her, thou art a God who sees. The angel is called deity. Second, even though the angel of Yahweh is called deity, we know a second thing. And for that, let's go to Zechariah 1, 12, and 13. We could show consistently that the angel of Yahweh is equal to Yahweh. He's called deity. He accepts worship. Zechariah
next to the last book of the Old Testament. And I'm simply using this to fill in one other thing about the angel of Jehovah. The angel of Yahweh and Yahweh are both viewed as deity. However, both are treated as separate. Chapter 1, verse 12 of Zechariah. And the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou have no compassion for Jerusalem and the cities of Judah? Why would we say, well, continuing, with which thou hast been indignant these 70 years? Notice in verse 12 that the angel of the Lord talks to the Lord. So they're treated as equal, and yet they talk to one another. And notice verse 13, Yahweh answered the angel. So this passage shows then that while they are consistently viewed, both of them as deity, and yet Zechariah points to the fact each has his own individuality. Each is individual. And for that evidence, I would simply say, no, they converse. Yahweh talks to the angel talks to Yahweh. Third, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten of the Father has manifested Him, and that is John 1:18. So the Son is the only one of the Trinity to be seen. Now that's a very short run-through, but we'll come to a conclusion. And that is the angel of Yahweh in the Old Testament is Christ pre-incarnate. Christ pre-incarnate. We know He existed before His birth in Bethlehem, and that manifestation, I believe, in the Old Testament is revealed in the angel of Yahweh. Now, taking that back to Psalm 34. The angel of the Lord, that is, in the Old Testament, Christ pre-incarnate, surrounds or encamps those who fear or respect Him and rescues them. So notice the basis then for the exhortation to look to the Lord, and the reason they do not need to fear is because of the constant presence of the Lord. That's the doctrine on which it rests. We are secure because of the presence of the Lord. Now, there's one other thing in this context. Notice in verse 8, 9, 10. And we'll caption this a little differently in a moment, but notice it. He says, O taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in Him. Now notice this verse. Fear the Lord, that means to respect His authority, you His saints, for to those who fear Him, there is no want. Question. What is the link between respect for the Lord and experiencing no want? How do those tie together? Well, they tie together in this way, that fear of the Lord means respect for His authority, and that means submission to Him. If we submit everything to Him, what does that do to Him? Does it not obligate those who submit to Him that He will supply their need? And therefore you have a link that if you will submit to His authority, He will care for you. And that's the promise that comes down in these following verses. Now, just a few ideas. In verse 8 through 10, he's going to talk about the that David's personal experience, and now B, the believer's potential experience. David's personal experience, the believer's potential experience, verses 8 on through the end of the Psalm, 14. And that will revolve about several things. Number one, we need to understand and focus on the promise. 8 through 10. Now notice, David uses an everyday expression to convey the idea of trusting the Lord or faith. And the expression he uses is taste and see that the Lord is good. I think it's interesting that the tasting precedes the seeing. The seeing does not precede the tasting. And the emphasis is perhaps much like if we go for seeing that the Lord is... If we reverse this, put yourself now in the historical situation, being pursued, you're in the cave of Adullam, you're among those who are bankrupt, you don't have anything, and someone comes along and says, look, look around you. And if you look around you, you know what you'll see? You'll see that the Lord is good. But that isn't what they would have seen in the cave of Adullam. They would look around at them and see that, I look around me, I've got this problem, that problem. And therefore, he does not say, see that the Lord is good. He says, taste and see. The idea involved is, many, many times, if you go to looking, you will never partake in anything. I love lobster. But the first time, I went on the basis of what I saw. And, you know, it just doesn't seem a sound principle to eat anything that's looking at you. And if there's anything that's ugly, it's got to be a lobster until you've tasted. And if it was a matter of, look at the lovely lobster, isn't it going to be wonderful to eat? No, it looks horrible. Can never forget. We'd been out for dinner one evening, and I think David was how old? 6, 7, something like that. And he was in bed when we got back, and we took the sitter home, and I brought home the lobster head, you know, the back part. And before I went to bed, just for fun, he heads for the bathroom first thing. We put it right on the edge of the stool, like the thing looking at you like here. Okay, the promise in verse, you know the rest. Okay, so a taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Oh, fear the Lord, respect his authority, you saints, for to those that fear him there is no want. In other words, if you will trust, the Lord will reward. Second, not only is it just trusting, but you got to focus on a process. And the process is in 11 and 12. Verse 11. Come, you children, listen to me. In the Old Testament, there is a body of literature, and we had it in the book of Proverbs, that sometimes is called Old Testament instruction literature. And it's self-explanatory for what it is, but in the instruction literature, you have inevitably a pattern. You have a pattern and you have a motif. First, the pattern in Old Testament instruction literature involves three things. First of all, an invitation to learn. Second, what do you think the second thing would be after the invitation to learn? It's a thing without which there can be no learning. After the invitation to learn, there is a command to respect the teacher. Then third, there is a stated reason or reasons to respect the teacher. That's the pattern. Second, there is a motif in all of the instructional literature. And the motif is family instruction. The motif is family. Notice you've got that here. Come down to verse 11. Come, you children. Notice the family motif. If this were in the book of Proverbs, which is instructional literature, it would be what? Typically, my son, something of that sort. Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Who is the man who desires life and who loves length of days that he may say good? Keep your tongue from evil, your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil, do good, seek peace, and pursue it. So you have the pattern and the motif of instruction coming in, and then you have following out the rest of... by the way, why would, when you come down to verse 34, or chapter 34... Why would the fear of the Lord describe the whole curriculum? Come, children, listen to me. I will teach you what? the fear of the Lord teach you to respect the Lord? And the answer to that is respect for God's authority is the whole foundation for all learning. We'll not go to it. You know it. Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is what? The beginning of wisdom. And that is so very, very important. I heard someone on the radio the other day, and it was a non-Christian, but he made a very, very good point. He said, have you observed today that education has nothing to do with character? Stop and think. The more education you get, the more honest a person you will be. Is that the way it follows? If you've got a PhD, you can trust him with your whole bank account. A master's degree, not quite so much. And he was simply noting that that with education, you do not necessarily increase character. And that is so different from the Old Testament. Because in the Old Testament, a man who has no character is a fool. And if there isn't the righteousness to go along with it, then the knowledge is simply not recognized. The fool, get that, the fool has said in his heart, there's no God. There is no God, the fool. There are many a PhD that does not believe in God. Have you ever encountered one? What is he from biblical standpoint? And it's not an assault on character, it's just a statement of Scripture. A fool. And therefore, wisdom, and you can see in this context that wisdom and right conduct is intimately tied together as far as the Bible is concerned. We, unfortunately, have lost that. Note one other thing, by the way. Respect for the Lord is innate. If it is, why does it need to be taught? So notice in verse 11, respect for the Lord is something that has to be taught. And notice not only is it something that has to be taught, but I think there's encouragement, it can be taught. And he's simply saying, come and I will teach you that kind of respect. Then you have in 13 and 14 the emphasis on pursuit. Winding up, verse 14, depart from evil, do good, seek peace, and pursue it. See, in the Old Testament, again, there was never peace until evil was dealt with. And the prime example of that has to be the cross, doesn't it? There could be no peace with God until evil was dealt with and sin was dealt with. And therefore, Christ must suffer until sin is dealt with, and then we can have peace. 20th century mentality, we want peace. But not only will we not deal with evil, we don't even recognize evil. And that, again, is far, far removed from the Scriptures. Now, closing out, in the 15th through 22nd verse, we have the motivation to respect the Lord's authority. And we begin, and really have as a basis for understanding, three quick anthropomorphisms. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous. His ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against evildoers. Notice he's giving motivation. Here's some good reasons why you ought to respect him. If you don't, his face is against you. If you do, his ears are open to your cry, and his eyes are open to see you. Now, let's do just a little breakout here into two words, and we've been over them before, but let's put them, if we can, in a capsule form. The opening two verses have anthro, and this is a word you really ought to know, at least what it means, have an anthropomorphism. Now, what do we mean by an anthropomorphism? Let's give it a little definition. It's really simple. It's the word anthropos, meaning man, and morphos, meaning form. Put something in a man form. Interesting thing, I don't think we'll get to it tonight, but if you look at the Bible, the God of the Old Testament is represented anthropomorphically, in other words, under the idea of human eyes, human ears, human face. We got three of them in those verses. Do you know, in almost all of your ancient religions, they represent their God morphically, except it is inevitably zoomorphically, under the form of animals. And that's one of the great distinguishing points between the Hebrew Old Testament or the
the religion of the Old Testament in Israel and the rest of it. It's anthropomorphic versus zoopomorphic, which you have in the ancient religions. Definition. Anthropomorphism is the assigning of human characteristics to God. Simple. Assigning of human characteristics to God. Now, just for information, if we would go anthropopathism, that is assigning human feelings to God. But for all practical purposes, I think we can put them all under one umbrella and call them anthropomorphisms. There are three of them. Notice in verse 15, 16, the eyes of the Lord. Notice human characteristic of eyes is assigned to God. His ears, human characteristic of hearing assigned to God. The face of the Lord is against evil doers. Now, what are the reasons for doing that? Why are the reasons? Or what are the reasons? Number one. God uses anthropomorphisms in His Word in order to communicate truth in a framework we can understand. In order to communicate truth in a framework that we are able to understand. Bible is not a book of abstractions about God. The Bible does not read like a philosophy book, which may become so abstract that you're reading sentences like, in order to be, one must become what one should be in order to become. And you look at it and read it five times and you still don't understand it. That's abstraction. The Bible does not do that. It puts it in a framework that man is familiar with, and we're familiar with ears, with hearing, with seeing, with looking, and God communicates that way. Second, it is needed because God is invisible. See why we need it? It is needed because God is invisible. Now, what is it really that makes it effective? Anthropomorphisms are effective because man is made in the image of God. In other words, it's effective because of Genesis 1:26. Effective, made in God's image. Now you say, how would that make it effective? If, now granted, man is a depraved creature, but if man is made in God's image, and you look at man, what are you seeing? The reflection of God. Now, again, granted, man is fallen. But it is also true that man is made in God's image. And therefore, when you look at man, you get a little picture of God, even an unsaved man. Because you look at a man making a decision. Well, God makes decisions. It's called sovereignty. You see man learning things. God knows things, too. It's called omniscience. You see man looking around observing things and seeing things. Granted, it's limited, but when you amplify that to God, God is omnipresent. So what you really see then is that ingrained in man, his seeing, his knowing, his hearing, his looking, his deciding, is all a little mini atom-sized reflection of what those things are in God in the fullest sense. And therefore, there's a sense in which we can say this, do you want to know what God is like? Look at man. Now, I hope you got that in the right context. Granting that man is a depraved creature, but from the standpoint of knowing, from learning, from willing, from deciding, and observing, from that standpoint, those things are mini-sized in man, maxi in God. And those are three good reasons for using anthropomorphisms as the Scripture does. And therefore, throughout the rest of this psalm, David dwells on the fact that God responds to both the righteous and the good and its motivation for learning. That's what was taking place in the cave of Adullam. Now let's go to Psalm 1 Samuel, and we'll not go back to it. 1 Samuel 22, verse 1. We've got two more psalms that are based there. And let's go to Psalm 142. Psalm 142. If you mark in Samuel, you should have something like this. You should have 1 Samuel 21:10 beside it, Psalm 56. Then at 1 Samuel 21:13, you should have Psalm 34. And then in 1 Samuel 22:1, you should have Psalm 142 and Psalm 57. Because they're the spiritual insight into the history recorded in this part of 1 Samuel. So let's go now to Psalm 142. And make a few remarks by way of introduction to it, the psalm. And the first one is this. Keep in mind that in these psalms, David is in his fugitive days, anointed as king by Samuel, but he is in his fugitive days. His fugitive days, as far as the content of Scripture is concerned, is 1 Samuel 18 through 31. The time involved is about 30 years. Then we'll find him in 2 Samuel coming to the throne over Judah, and then we'll have him as king over all Israel. But right now, we're strictly in his fugitive days. We have in 1 Samuel 8 psalms are directly tied to these days. And by the way, when we have little superscriptions that give us the historical setting, such as in Psalm 142 that says, a maskil of David when he was in the cave, even though we've been going over these as though they were present in the Psalms in abundance, they're not. Whenever the Holy Spirit stops to tie in a psalm to a historical event, believe me, that's rare. Because if you go throughout Psalms, you do not find these in abundance. And I hope we haven't conveyed a wrong idea, because every one we've been looking at, we've been going to the superscription, then back to Samuel, as though these things are present all the way through. These eight psalms, that's a rarity. This is not a common thing at all. Eight of them are tied in. Now, and that is for 1 Samuel 18 through 31. Eight psalms tied in to the period of 1 Samuel 18 through 31. Second, 1 Samuel 19 through 26. That's cutting into that big part. 1 Samuel 19 through 26 is the background for five of them. See, we're getting real concentrated. The last half of the book, 18 through 31, ties into eight of them. Narrow it down. 19 through 26 accounts for five out of the eight of those psalms that are going to tie into this particular section. So in the place we are in 1 Samuel, we're in a very, very heavy concentration of these particular type psalms. Second thing about Psalm 142 is it is called, as far as form, it is an individual, meaning it's not the nation, but it's an individual speaking. It's an individual lament. Remember, we got two types. You can have an individual lament or a national lament, or an individual praise and a national praise. How do you tell whether a psalm is lament or praise? And the answer to that is weigh it. How much of it is lament? Is more of it lament than praise? It's a lament psalm. Is more of it praise than lament? It's a praise psalm. So that in every one of them, you've got a mixture of both. It's just which is predominant. And in this psalm in 142, the big bulk of it is lament. He's lamenting his situation as he is pursued by Saul. Now, the form goes like this. It begins with address to God. Then, immediately following the address is the complaint or the lament. Now, the way you can usually identify a lament is look for the I, you, and they format in some way. And the I, you, and they format is looking at this. I have suffered in such a way, you, Lord, have allowed it, and they have overwhelmed me. And that's usually the way he puts his lament together. May I repeat? It's simply the way you can pick up a psalm, and if it's a lament, you can identify the lament. It's usually the words of the speaker, God, and the enemy. And it's, I have suffered, you have allowed it, and they have overwhelmed me. That's the lament part, and we'll have that in this particular psalm. Then following that is a little section of trust. Thing to remember about the trust psalm, trust part of these psalms, however, is it floats. It can be anywhere. Sometimes, in order to get the point across, and this is one of the psalms that does it, he will mix the lament and trust together, and he will put a trust statement, then he will put a lament statement, and then he will put a trust statement. And that's sort of a form way of saying, I'm in big trouble, but I've got it all bracketed okay. I've got my lament and my problem all bracketed with faith on both sides. And it's kind of a neat little way with the form of putting those things together. And that's the message we've got in Psalm 142. We'll show it when we come to it. So it can be anywhere. And the other thing to say about that is the best way to identify it is it's the place in the psalm where there's a turn to God. It's the turn to God point. The strongest and easiest way to identify that, though not always the case, is when he goes, but thou. Talk about the problem and all the difficulties, and he says, but thou, or but you. Turn to God part. And then that is followed by a petition. And that is followed by praise. And in those individual psalms, you're always going to have those things in some way. Now, we can't ever make this rigid. You can't say it's got to be that order. This is the typical order of an individual lament psalm. However, there's freedom for him to come along and say, I would like to kind of play with the form a little bit. And I'd like to change it around and shift this from here to here and move this up here. And whenever he does that, we always want to ask, why did he do that? What was the reason? And in this psalm, he will kind of take the lament and trust and say, I'd like to mix those together. And I would like to make a sandwich out of it. And I would like to use as the filling for the sandwich, lament, and a piece of bread on each side of it to cover it over, which is called trust. So he kind of makes a trust sandwich out of the thing, showing that trust is the predominant thing, but sandwiched in between is his lament. And so that will often change around. Okay, let's start then with Psalm 142. David addresses God. And that's found in verses 1, 2, and 2. Now, let's move back into our superscription because verse 1 actually starts with the word maskil. That's part of the Hebrew text. So, the psalm is identified for us two ways. It is identified as to the type. It is a maskil. Maskil comes from a very common verb in Hebrew, shakal, which is a word for wisdom. It's called a maskil. A maskil is an instructional psalm, a teaching psalm. It means that the intent of it is to impart wisdom to a believer or to the reader. It's a teaching psalm. Now, a teaching psalm would be one where the psalmist takes his experience and he directs it to an audience. Now, that's why when we come to, and I want you to see two address to God sections. The first one is in Psalm 142, 1 and 2. And the second is Psalm 143, verse 1. Now, let me read each one of them, and you tell me what's different. 142 reading first. I cry aloud with my voice to the Lord. I make supplication with my voice to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before Him. I declare my trouble before Him. Okay, got it? Now go to 143. And how's this different? Hear my prayer, O Lord. What's the difference? The difference in Psalm 143 is he talks to God. In Psalm 142, he talks about God. You see that? 142, address to God section, is something he says about God. 143, the address section, is made up of what he says to God. Why would that be? Why would that be? Well, the reason that you have the difference is Psalm 142 is a teaching psalm, a maskil. Psalm 143 is not a maskil or instructional song. And so the reason then would be in Psalm 142, he's talking about God to whom? The learners. And in chapter 143, he's talking only to God, and his major concern is not you or me. I mean, we benefit. But he is not concerned about whether anybody really is listening or not. He just says, oh God, I've got something to say to you. And if we happen to be sitting listening on, that's okay, but that's not his point. In Psalm 142, he says, hey, you guys out there, I want you to learn something. And therefore, I'm going to talk to you about God, and that's why the address section changes in this particular section. So as to type, then, it's a maskil, and it is designed for us. And thus, universal experience and universal solution. Universal experience and universal solution. Timeless solution for us also. We should be able to identify with it. It's then identified as to place in the superscription. It takes place in a cave, and we have two possibilities. 1 Samuel 22, verse 1, that we've already read, Cave of Adullam, or it could be 1 Samuel 24 and verse 3, where he's in another cave. I see no reason why it would not perhaps apply to both. It certainly would apply to both. All right, with that then, let's look at the words. The words of verse 2. There is an emphasis in the Hebrew Bible in lines 1 and 2. Can you pick out what you think the emphasis might be? What would be let's put it this way. There are certain words in verse 1, lines 1 and 2 of the text below the superscription. There are certain words that are underscored if you're reading in a Hebrew Bible, and you'd see those underlines. I don't mean they really underline, but by the arrangement of the sentence and the syntax, they're underlined words. The underlined words are the words to the Lord in both lines. I cry aloud with my voice to the Lord. I make my supplication with my voice to the Lord. Those are the emphatic words. Emphasis is to the Lord. And what is involved in that is just this. David is at the point where there is nothing left but the Lord. In other words, I make my prayer to the Lord because there's nobody else to help me. Look down at verse 4. He says, look to the right and see, for there's no one who regards me. There is no escape for me. No one cares for my soul.
And thus, what does he do in verse 1? That is turned into a blessing. Because nobody can be found that is for him, what does he do? He turns to the Lord. This is the called the blessing of abandoned friends. They all leave him, and in turn, that blesses him and causes him to turn to the Lord. David has reached the point where there's no human help left, and he is emphasis as simply saying, if I could paraphrase, Lord, I call on you because there's nobody else left to call on. It certainly shows the depth of David's faith also in that he's trusting the Lord alone. Also in that, notice this. David always treats God as personal. David treats God as personal. Notice in verse 2 how hesitant. Notice the trepidation in these verses. I pour out my complaint before him. Now again, we don't want to do that. As we said, if we would do anything like that, thunder would rattle and we would be struck with lightning immediately. But that's not David. David is totally open with the Lord. I pour out my complaint before him. I declare my trouble before him. And so notice, and again, you can think of the cathartic effect of that, of getting it off of his chest and communicating it to the Lord. I think this also shows that this is another place where David contrasts Saul so totally. Show me one passage where Saul ever has any intimate, personal communication with the Lord. The only thing that Saul has is a formal nod to God, tip the hat. But he is never, never personal. There are no intimate with God passages that you can find in connection with Saul in any way. David was always relaxed. Do you ever get any sense that David is not relaxed in the presence of God? You read through these Psalms and you say, this man is absolutely, hangs it all out. He's really loose. You don't sense any hesitancy. Now, Lord, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Pardon me, but may I tell you a little thing that is bugging me slightly? I mean, he kicks the door open and comes in and totally expresses himself as far as the Lord is concerned. Saul's address of God is always formal and impersonal, not David. Now, that pouring out of his feeling is both objective and subjective. The pouring out is objective and subjective. Now, what do we mean by that? It is objective and it is also subjective. First of all, this pouring out had a subjective effect on David, and it had an objective effect on God. First of all, it had a subjective effect on David. Reading in verse 2, I pour out my complaint before him in order to inform him. Is that David's thought? Is he pouring out the complaint so God will know? And if he doesn't, it, God would go uninformed and would not know. I declare my trouble before him. Well, let's put down, first of all, that these words are not to inform. In other words, when David told God all about his troubles, God didn't learn anything that he didn't already know. But it is interesting that even though God knew all about David, it really helped to tell God about it. You've probably experienced that on the human level, have you not? Is you got a friend and they know all about it, but boy, it really helps to spell it out again. And the same thing is true on the divine level, and I think it's very, very important to note that when David, in verse 2, is telling God about his troubles, you know what his mind is also on? The fact that God knows it all. Well, that's strange. If God knows it all, why tell him? Notice you got verse 2, he's informing God, and in verse 3, second line down, he's saying God knows all about it. So verse 2, I pour out my complaint before him. I declare my trouble before him. When my spirit was overwhelmed with me, you knew my path. In other words, he is not telling this in order to inform God. David is very aware of the omniscience of God. In fact, that's his comfort, the fact that God knows all about him. But it's interesting that even though God knew all about it, it helped David to tell God about it. So it helps subjectively to tell. Very, very personal. Actually, the words before him in Hebrew are to his face. I poured out my complaint right in his face. I declare my trouble in the face of God, literally. So the subjective effect on David. There was also an objective effect on God. In other words, his petitions did something. It affected God in an objective way. And we'll see that as we come to the completion of it. God responds to David's petitions by actually and really doing something about it in time. And we will pick up at that point now. David addresses God, and we will come now to our second point, which is David laments / trusts. 142:3-5. And we will see put together there into one unit, woven together, the lament section and the trust section that is there. One thing in closing. In verse 2, David is very specific that he tells God about his problem. Now, you would think that it would read this way. Verse 2, I will pour out my complaint before him, declare my trouble before him. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, thou didst know my complaint and my trouble. But he doesn't say that. He says, you know my path. And path is his whole life. Why, in the midst of a problem, does he look at the way God is dealing with his whole life? I think you ought to know the answer to that. When you focus on a problem, what usually happens to everything else? When you focus on a problem, you usually forget everything else that's good, don't you? I mean, it doesn't make any difference. If you've had 40 years of blessing, you're in hot water now, you focus on the problem, and that's all you see, and you forget the 40 years of blessing. Well, David is smart enough to know that I can pour out my specific problem to God, but look at my whole life. He knows everything about it. In other words, this gave him perspective. He looked at the complaint and the trouble of the moment as only an element of his life, not his whole life. And that, of course, is ultimately extremely practical there. In other words, it was verse 2, tell God the problem and focus on the whole life for the solution. I remember, I think it was Dr. Walford at Dallas Seminary used to tell us, he said,